have Mark Maron with Stu Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Today, our very first summer edition of the President's Palm Violet and our liberal agenda for all you good knee-jerking liberals out there. Today is the first day of summer. I'm Mark Maron. I'm here with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's amazing how quickly it happens, man. You know, summer comes in New York and bam, it's so humid you can't even walk outside. You're covered with sweat and exhausted.
Not yet.
It's nice.
Not yet. It's early. It's early and it's kind of cool this morning.
Yesterday was nice. It was perfect day. The day before was sort of like, you know, when when it's summer in New York and just waiting. It took me years for some reason to get an air conditioner. I don't know what it is that you think summer's just going to blow past. You're like, I'll just use 50 fans. And you sit in your apartment sweating like you have malaria, wondering whether or not you're sick. And then someone goes, maybe you should just get an air conditioner. Why? It's going to be over soon. But why do you got to sit there and sweat and be exhausted and miserable and roll around in wet sheets? Ugh. So I have an air conditioner, and it was the greatest thing in the world. Did you have a good weekend?
I did, but you know, there's a problem with air conditioners in New York. Not a problem with air conditioners, a problem with some apartment houses.
You don't got to tell me, man. I went through
the ones that crank out.
The old breaker system?
Yeah. No, the windows that crank out hardest windows to install air conditioners in. You really got to get a professional to come in to put it in.
I did that once when you're rocking out the window and you're just realizing, like, man, this could go down. I hope there's no one under there.
And land on somebody's head, yeah.
And then the other problem is I live in one of these pre-war buildings in Queens, you know, so it took my landlord a long time. None of these breaker systems were made for computers and air conditioners, so every summer there'd be these weird impromptu meetings of the tenants downstairs at 1 in the morning sweating, going, is your off? Yeah, the whole building's off. And we couldn't get the landlord to come out. He finally replaced the electrical system. You know, and just one day these guys came into my apartment and said, we're putting new wires in, and they ripped my ceiling out.
Yeah.
And covered the entire apartment with dust for days. I'm like, is he going to fix this? Yeah, we'll get to it. You know, I'm like, unbelievable. So my wife's been in town all weekend, and that's been good. Father's Day, did your kid give you a nice thing? Macaroni, covered cigar box or something?
No, actually, I have a 12 noon, courtesy of my wife and daughter. Deep tissue, full body, 1 hour something.
Listen to Riley. He's like, I never heard of this kind. You know, the happy ending one I heard of.
Yeah.
But this one, the deep tissue, legit massage.
Legit massages by licensed masseuses. Yeah. Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Those I've never heard of.
Yeah.
Now, massage parlors, that's a whole different thing.
I haven't had one in a while. I like them.
Yeah.
I called my dad on Father's Day. You got to be careful now with these older people with the cell phones. You just got to be careful. Because I called my dad, and he's like, wait, whoa. And I'm like, what's going on? He goes, I'm on a bike. I'm like, well, dude, the guy's like in his 60s. It's like, I'll call you back. Call me back when he stopped the bike, you know? But he was happy I called him. It always surprises him that I love him. just the way he is. He's such a bitter bastard. He's like, why? I'm like, I love you. Happy Father's Day. He's like, oh, well, thank you. That's nice of you to call. Thanks a lot.
By the way, Maron, I went to a church service commemorating the start of Pride Week, which actually starts, I think, either yesterday or today, Gay Pride Week.
Mm-hmm.
And my parish priest gave a sermon that would have made you proud.
Oh, yeah?
About the dangers of right-wing fundamental Christianity.
Yeah. What do you have to say?
He said, look.
He said they're sneaking in.
You all better stand up now, or you're not going to be able to stand up later,
well,
because these people are about to gut your rights.
I think that, you know, out of all the support we've had around talking about extreme Christianity in this country, I think it's important to realize that, you know, in retrospect and in my current state, you know, I'm not, you can believe whatever you want. I just think that if you believe in something that has anything remotely to do with Christianity, you should be very critical of Christian extremists in this country and their agenda.
Absolutely.
I believe that to be true.
Absolutely.
And what else do I want to talk about? I guess we could do the news. Do you know anything about this Soho Club?
Which Soho Club?
Do you know about the Soho Club?
Soho in New York or Soho in London?
It's the same one.
I do. Sorry. Yes, I do. It's a private club. The one where Jude Law's daughter swallowed an ecstasy tablet last year, and it was a big scandal.
Well, I don't know about that, but I have some friends who invited us to the one in New York, so I went to the Soho Club. I was hanging out with British people.
Oh, my God.
And it was very
How
pleasant.
Are they doing now?
The British people? I don't know. I can't generalize. You know, these two were very nice. And my wife's friends and our friends invited us. And it's up on a roof, and there's a pool. And it was pretty she-she, pretty fancy.
Soho
hanging out with
Club?
The,
yeah, I used to be part of a group of women who worked in television, and we used to meet every other week at the Soho Club in London.
Yeah, it's
in
like
London,
a media
it's like a rickety
thing.
Sort of, it's like an old townhouse in the middle of Soho with narrow staircases and... It's yeah, it's kind of like a media celebrity
yeah, I heard it was
kind
the,
of hangout place.
The one
it's
in,
kind of a cool club, actually.
The one in London's a little more clicky than this one. I heard
oh,
that.
Oh, that's just British life. We're so clicky.
Yeah, well, the one, we just had lunch, and it only cost me, you know, like $80 for two salads. So it was really a great day.
I have a question. How long has this Soho Club been open?
It hasn't been around that long.
It's down
the meatpacking district and the newly revitalized meatpacking.
Yes.
Have you been down there? I mean,
where they
so
no
like...
longer pack meat.
No, no. Well. And they no longer pack other things either, I don't think. I think it's pretty... I think all of that has moved away. Sorry. But they have moved up. Most of it's...
See, I was trying to be subtle.
It's wasted around here.
No, subtlety takes a backseat to nothing around here. Listen, we got to do the news, all right?
Go ahead, go ahead, go ahead.
We'll get back to meatpacking in Soho later. Anyway, the war on terror has morphed into a war of words between the 9/11 Commission and the Bush White House. The dispute is raging on several fronts. We talked about a couple of them on Friday. The administration continues to argue there's a link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, while Commission Chair Tom Kaine said over the weekend that al-Qaeda had more interaction with, get this, Mark Maron, Iran and Pakistan than it did with Iraq. His remarks come as Vice President Cheney continues to defend his assertion that Saddam and al-Qaeda were linked. Cheney says he has intelligence on the issue that the commission is not aware of. Commission Chair Tom Kaine says if that's true, he needs to share it.
Obviously, if there is any information still that has to do with the subject of the report, we need it. And we need it pretty fast, but we'll ask for it and see. And if the administration has information that we don't have, then hopefully we'll have it very soon.
They're busy fabricating the evidence now. It takes time to make it look authentic. So give them a couple more weeks, and they'll have it to you.
Pretty accommodating, wouldn't it?
I can't believe that Cheney's doing this. He's literally infantilizing the committee.
He's
literally playing politics and saying, well, that's, I'm glad that you guys did this little paper thing that you, I'm glad you typed all this stuff up, but you know, I'm the vice president and I got stuff that you might not have. So good job at whatever you did there. And when you want to play with the grown-ups, you know, let us know.
But hang on. I mean, the committee is somewhat guilty of infantilizing itself. From one report I saw this morning, I'm just trying to find it again on the computer. They had softened some of their language that was critical of the Bush administration because of pressure from White House lawyers. I was staggered when I saw that.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do know exactly what you're talking about. In fact, they did say that they excised some of the language that the administration had a problem with, specifically about whether or not Dick Cheney had spoken to George W. Bush before he gave the order to
shoot
down
the
planes, which of course was moot because by the time he gave it, all of the planes had crashed.
But how independent is that? Sending your primary findings, your report, off to the White House, the lawyers then say, no, hang on, this is too strong. We want you to really kind of soften your language here. And you go, okay.
But wait, isn't it important that this panel look nonpartisan? And if it does come across as partisan, they can dismiss it even more easily?
Well, the House has already started.
Right. So isn't it important that they sort of navigate those waters and make it seem like it is not completely partisan if it is, so it has some effect?
It is important that it comes across as nonpartisan, but I really, you know, we've had so much trouble with kind of, you know, White House lawyers putting pressure on, you know, on people to be able to not say things, and, you know, White House lawyers kind of pushing the envelope on what can or cannot be said, you know, including the whole, you know, what is acceptable in terms of, you know, torture in Iraq. I'm scared of White House lawyers being involved in anything.
Still ahead, we're going to take your calls. We're at 866-303-AAR0. That's 866-303-2270. Plus, what do you hear about the new book coming out from a Bush insider? I can't wait for this thing. We'll be right back on Air America Radio. Eighteen past the hour, morning's edition, Mark Maron, Sue Elcott, Mark Riley. Who is in charge? I mean, there's a real conversation here, you know, amongst the committee and amongst people in general in the timeline of what happened on 9/11 as to whether or not you know, Cheney actually talked to the president about whether or not he could or couldn't give the order to shoot planes down. And some, you know, some people are speculating that he went ahead and just took it.
You know, he may end up being dog of the week 2 weeks running at the rate he's going. I mean, this is between this and the idea that, Cheney would casually say, well, I have intelligence that the 9/11 Commission did not have and that I did not share with the 9/11 Commission in terms of the link between Saddam and al-Qaeda. These are some very, very real questions. And if this report comes out on July 26th and these questions are not resolved, it could mean, quite frankly, the Bush presidency, if they're not careful. Cheney needs to be able to say there was a phone call at a specific time. Condoleezza Rice says she remembers a phone call, but she doesn't get into anything more specific than remembering
a phone call. They're being cagey about it, which makes me suspect that they're watching their butts.
Well,
you know what I mean?
And the scary part about this is a White House aide by the name of Joshua Bolton. He was the deputy chief of staff. He asked Cheney, now this is on September 11th, asked Cheney to get back in touch with the president to confirm the order to shoot down the planes. What that means is that somebody on the White House staff was not at all sure that that order had in fact been given by the president. He thought Cheney had taken it upon himself.
So he was saying he was checking him.
Yes!
That's unbelievable.
And by the way, he is Cheney's subordinate.
But he was like, he knew that there was some sort of chain of command that was being abused and that you better watch your ass here, Mr. Vice President.
Yeah. Now, there were no other note. There were two note takers in the room at the time all this was taking place. One was Scooter Libby, who is Cheney's chief of staff, who was supposed to be a very meticulous record keeper. The other was Lynn Cheney, Dick Cheney's wife. There is no evidence, at least from the people in that room or any of the notes that were taken in that room, that there was a conversation between George W. Bush and Dick Cheney where Bush said, take down the planes.
Now, hold on. Why is Lynn Cheney in the room as a note taker? Was she just happened to be there, or is she being employed as a note taker?
Interesting question.
Maybe she's always taking notes. Maybe she just follows him around and takes notes.
Yeah. Well, you know, if it was Bill Clinton and Hillary had been there, there'd have been an investigation by now.
They should be investigating more of these people. I mean, Dick Cheney's, you know, audacity and his arrogance is insane. I mean, they're playing to these people in the country that are actually think that, hey, they're in charge. They should be, they can do whatever they need to do. We don't have to know everything.
But see, this is what gets to what Sue was talking about earlier. Is the commission now, in an effort to seem nonpartisan, going to bend over, essentially? Have they bent over already and taken out some of the language that perhaps should have been there about these questions? Because according to the commission now, let's be real clear about what the commission says about the phone call. According to the report, there is no documentary evidence for this call. That's what the commission report apparently initially
said. So that means it's not on the record. That there was a call.
There is no evidence that a call took place.
So there's a real good chance that Bush was, you know, finishing up reading his storybook down in Florida or on a plane, not knowing where they were going to go. And Cheney was running the country, you know, illegally on some level.
Well, he was prepared to take American lives without checking with the commander in chief. And there is some question, and I think we talked about this a very little bit on Friday. There's some question now about whether or not Dick Cheney was the person in the chain of command who was supposed to unilaterally make that order in the absence of the president.
Right. It might be the Secretary of State. I don't know.
Secretary of Defense, maybe somebody, but not necessarily
the VP.
Dick Cheney. Now, the other thing that I think people ought to be aware of here is the idea that Dick Cheney is saying, well, I have intelligence that you all don't have about these links between Saddam and al-Qaeda. Remember, it was Dick Cheney who had his chauffeur drive him to CIA headquarters on more than one occasion and told them, we want certain kinds of intelligence that we're not getting.
Yeah, he got this wrong. We need something that looks to fit our agenda a little better.
Yeah.
Well, the report that he told CNBC that there probably were things about Iraq's links to terrorists that the commission members did not learn during their 14-month investigation. Well, Cheney certainly had time and an opportunity to tell them. I mean, if they didn't know it and they should have known it, then it's, you know, it's his omission more than anything else. But I think it's a sort of an alarming phase that we're in with the 9/11 Commission now, that the Bush administration clearly wants to do its utmost to kind of undermine anything that comes across as authoritative and challenges
the credibility of it.
What challenges the Bush administration? I mean, it's not a big surprise that the chairman said over the weekend that al-Qaeda had much more connection with Iran or Pakistan than it did with Iraq. Richard Clark, the former National Security Advisor, said the same stuff, you know, publicly. I'm sure he said it before, but he said it quite clearly last week. And the point he made to the Independent newspaper was that the administration should not have put as much money into Iraq. The world would be safer. America would be safer if they put money into anti-terrorism aimed at Pakistan and Iran, and that that side of things have been completely overlooked by the obsession with Iraq.
Well, the frightening thing too about them trying to say the commission is not have all the information is that means that they are saying they are continuing to keep secrets from the American public, that this commission was put together to provide some truthful insight into the shortcomings of the intelligence system, of the military's preparedness in a situation like that. And this administration, Dick Cheney, you know, insists on maintaining secrecy in the face of the commission's, you know, results, mm-hmm. and saying that we still have stuff that you don't have and we're not going to tell you because why? Why would they keep secrets at this time? I think he's just playing it.
Well, you know, one published report here has both Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton, the former congressman, the Democrat, who's also on the commission, as being stunned when Dick Cheney said, I have additional intelligence. See, because they're sitting there thinking, okay, well, he had been forthcoming with us. We're trying to reconcile everything. We're not trying to get at odds with the Bush administration. We're trying to be nonpartisan. And here comes this guy, the vice president of the United States, essentially saying, well, yeah, we withheld stuff from you. We got more intelligence than we let you know.
Because it's our job. We're in charge, and we can't tell you everything.
But see, here's the risk that these guys run. And I'm talking about now Bush Cheney.
Yeah.
The risk is this is, in fact, a bipartisan commission.
Right.
This has Tom Kaine as its chair. Tom Kaine is no rabble-rousing radical. He is a moderate Republican, a former governor, not a guy who's given to a great deal of hype, not a guy that you can say is out to get George W. Bush. Nothing could be further from the truth. John Lehman, who's incredibly trying to say now that he has new intelligence, that maybe some guy who was a lieutenant colonel in Saddam's Fedayeen was also an al-Qaeda operative. But now there's a question as to whether or not it's simply a matter of people having the same last name.
Yeah, because the name is sort of like Smith or
Shakir.
Sanchez.
Yeah.
But they're playing with fire here, don't you think? I think that anything that looks as though they are going after the 9/11 Commission and trying to undermine it, trying to make it look as though they didn't really have all the facts. I mean, how long have they spent on this? 14 months?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have gathered an incredible amount of intelligence from all sorts of sources. They have, you know, more than... Isn't it if the Bush administration has done its own investigation and said that we come up with different stuff? I mean, they have stonewalled this thing from the beginning. They didn't even want it to exist.
But Bush has an ally now in Republican members in Congress who are also calling into question the nonpartisan nature of the commission. There's a group of Republicans in the House of Representatives
who are saying it's a Democratic assault.
It is a Democratic assault. It's Bush bashing. It's happening during an election year, and it is, in fact, taking place to undermine Bush's reelection.
You know, Democratic with a small D. Sorry, the twist on that is that it is not kind of fully kind of Republican in the sense that the Bush administration thinks what is Republican. It's Democratic in as much as it's serving the interest of the people and it's taking information kind of from many sources and not proceeding with a foregone conclusion, which is how the Bush administration does things.
Mm-hmm.
It challenges the Bush administration can't handle anything that proceeds kind of fairly with an open mind because that's not the way they do things.
Well, it may not be the way they do things now, but at the rate they're going, fighting these battles on several fronts, and of course, in advance of both the June 30th handover of power in Iraq and the July 26th release of the 9/11 report, and by the way, that report is released on the first day, in case people didn't notice, of the Democratic National Convention. Think about that for a minute.
So I'm just trying to figure out in my head how many, you know, how many angles they're working here. So they got guys in Congress who are saying that the committee is a partisan event. They've got the vice president saying that I've got information
you
that
don't
you
know.
Don't.
Yeah.
And the commission is saying, well, if you do, so they're trying to make this committee look powerless, and this committee was supposed to make the people of this country more informed.
And they're trying to make the commission's conclusions look suspect. That's number one on their list. Still to come, the presidential palm pilot, the liberal agenda direct from the Streisand compound, some information about a book by a man named Anonymous, plus you on the phones at 866-303-AAR0. This is Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning. Mark Maron here on Morning's Edition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott.
Hey.
We're taking your calls at 866-303-2270, 866-AAR0. We also have our new blog is up. The blog is up. Morningsedition.com.
That's right.
Go there.
Send us hello. Send us your love. Send us your hate.
Right now I got the president's palm pilot. My guy in the Oval Office has downloaded the president's schedule for today. Here we go. 7 o'clock a.m. Wake up. Stay on message. We won't cut and run. 8 o'clock a.m. Cabinet meeting. Topic, cutting and running. 8:30 a.m. Meet with speechwriters about replacing the words cut and run. Suggest peace with honor. Or here's your freedom. Now enjoy your civil war. Or mission accomplished, on to Syria. There you go. 12:05 p.m. Look into having Fahrenheit 9/11 sealed as a classified presidential document. 1:30 p.m. Start reading Clinton's book. 1:33 p.m. Have staffer finish Clinton's book. 4 p.m. Make bold stance against beheading. Reassure the South that hanging is still okay. 5 p.m. Initiate Operation Distract Voters with the Olympics. 6 p.m. Devise bold visionary plan for universal health care. 6:15 p.m. Get distracted by yummy pudding. Abandon bold visionary plan for universal health care. And 9 p.m. lights out. Wow. Clinton got to sleep on the couch. Cool. 866-303-2270 is our number. You can call us up. 866-303-2270. We're going to Pascual in Spain. How are you?
Good morning. How are you guys?
I'm pretty good, man.
Morning.
Pretty good.
It's been a long time. Well, a few weeks.
Nice to talk to you again. How's everything going over there?
Well, a little rain today, but other than that, Spain is gorgeous, as always.
Oh, great. So,
in part of what you were talking about, my biggest fear, being an ex-cop from Illinois for 13 years, is in order to catch the perpetrator, you have to get into their mind or become the perp itself. My biggest concern is what they have been doing over the last 3.5 years, or basically 3 years, is staying in between some, certain guidelines and pushing their agenda, as I call it, to the max as far as taking away our national parks and trying to take away our freedoms on our Constitution and so on.
You're talking about the Patriot Act?
Yeah, the Patriot Act.
What perpetrator are you talking about exactly here?
Well, any kind of a perpetrator.
So we're talking about terrorists?
Yeah, well, anytime you want to catch a thief, whether it's a burglar, you have to become him. You have to actually think the way they would think.
Okay, so what are you suggesting?
My concern is the gloves are on right now.
Right.
If they get reelected,
yes,
they don't have to worry about another reelection because they have to make sure they get reelected this term.
Right.
Come November, if they steal another election,
right,
Katie barred the door because the gloves are coming off. And yeah, you're going to see, as far as I'm concerned, and again, I'm a conspiracy theorist like you are,
yeah,
is that you're going to see all these freedoms disappear because they're trying to set their agenda. The arrogance of Ashcroft refusing to agree with or to comply with the with Congress as far as turning over memos, contempt of Congress,
yeah,
the way they keep pushing their thoughts process or their agenda into the American public where people actually believe what they are saying.
And we've got a new book here by an anonymous member of the U.S. intelligence, U.S. intelligence official, that they're going to publish this thing that says that bin Laden and al-Qaeda wants nothing more than another 4 years of Bush because nobody has rallied together the anti-American sentiment as much as this president has in the radical Islamic world. Mm-hmm. It's very frightening that, you know, if they are thinking that way, if Osama bin Laden is literally campaigning for Bush, mm-hmm, that if they were to do another terrorist attack with a dirty bomb or whatever, on American soil, you know, just to create enough panic in this country that Bush stays in office so they can consolidate their base. It's incredibly frightening. We have Chiffon Breath. Is that her name?
Really?
His name? Yes. Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
All right. My thing is that, well, first of all, we know they're criminals.
Right.
All right?
You're talking about Bush and Cheney.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we know that because they want to get caught, and that's why they gave us the Patriot Act.
They want to get caught.
Oh, absolutely. All criminals want to get caught.
So you're saying, okay, you're saying secretly as part of their psychology that they have a desire to get caught, so the big challenge is how long can they evade capture?
That's all.
It's a very interesting theory about self-sabotage, and I believe that on some level it's true, but I hope they get caught before November.
Yeah,
or I hope they catch them.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. And the other thing is, you know, like for you, like for yourself,
yes,
we don't get out of this life alive.
Yeah,
so don't worry about it.
Okay, Siobhan.
Not that we know of. Thank you very much.
By the way, you know that book you were talking about, which is called Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, says that the war has played essentially directly into the hands of bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and that they are more focused now than they were 3 years ago when they attacked the World Trade Center.
We've been saying that for weeks, that clearly the war on terror and the terrorist activity has become, you know, more, they're not winning the war on terror, they are exacerbating the war on terror, and Iraq has never been more full of terrorists than it is now. There really wasn't, from any indication, certainly from the 9/11, you know, panel, any connection between Iraq and terrorism until George Bush decided to attack it.
Well, you know, we're starting also to see some of the wages of incompetence here. There was a front page story in the Times yesterday that talked about the fact, and we've spoken about it before, that the Kurds are on the move in northern Iraq and are, in fact, evicting Arab settlers from land that they claim as their own. Now,
right.
This is not a 1,000-year-old claim or whatever. These are claims that go back 20, 30 years, in other words, a generation. So those people are still alive, and they are driving the Arabs off their land. And why would they be doing that now? Why would they be doing that?
Because they got a window of opportunity.
Exactly. They got a window of opportunity that was created by America's incompetence in dealing with the aftermath of the war in Iraq.
That's unbelievable. So so the Civil War prophecy might actually occur.
It could. It could.
We've got the liberal agenda up ahead, and we're going to tell you about a story the mainstream media aren't talking about but should. So you might want to stay here for that on Air America Radio. Three past the hour. It's Mark Maron on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. We'd like to invite you to morningsedition.com. We've got our blog up finally, and we can now be part of the modern world. We've taken the big evolutionary step into the ether, and we're beyond email now. We now have a blog, which you can also email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. Always enjoy the emails. So now turning to a rather even more serious situation in the Sudan. You know, the Rwanda genocide was not handled by this country in any way and allowed to happen under Clinton's watch in a lot of respects.
Bill Clinton said that this was one of his great regrets as president, was that he did not pay sufficient attention.
I don't think that anyone in this, like, you know, lately, you know, as I get more sober in my thinking, you know, the further away I get from distractions, mm-hmm. you know, when I really think about, you know, it's very hard to wrap your brain around. There were like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people killed in Rwanda with machetes by their neighbors. Like, and I can't, like, even if I think about the beheading that happened on Friday, which was horrible, you know, it's as somebody who covers the news and we talk about it every day, you know, it's, you can separate yourself from it in conversation, but if you really think about the horror of it, it's just mind-blowing. And this kind of thing, like what's going on in Sudan that you're going to talk about and set up for us, is to me, it baffles me that it happens in the modern world, and it is so horrifying and disturbing that I don't know why it isn't a priority to do something about it.
Three words.
Yeah.
Disputes over land.
Yes.
Whether it's the Kurds in northern Iraq, whether it's the Arabs in western Sudan, the disputes are over land. Also true in Zimbabwe, as another example.
But aren't they tribal and racial as well?
They're tribal and racial, but at their root is the issue of whether who owns and who controls a region. In the Sudan, we're talking about the Darfur region, which is in the western part of the country. Large numbers of Afro-Sudanese there. And the Arabs, Arab militias, supposedly or allegedly with the support of the government of Lieutenant General Omar Hassan Ahmed Bashir, have been going through these regions, displacing literally a million people, 30,000 killed, confirmed killed thus far, many of them, many of the refugees having to flee to neighboring Chad.
Aren't they putting them in camps and starving them to death?
Yeah, that's the other part. There could be as many as a million people starving to death. And now we should say there are efforts, or at least some people are saying, that the head of the Sudanese government, President Bashir, has ordered the complete mobilization to disarm these militias that are supposedly operating under his auspices. Not everybody, however, is buying the idea that the president in this case is actually going to disarm these folks, because they have supposedly acted on his behalf in the past. Over the weekend, there was a statement released by the Sudanese presidency. It says all government agencies should mobilize to, quote, control and pursue all outlaw groups, including rebels and Janjaweed. And Janjaweed is the local word for the Arab militias. And, of course, the rebels in Darfur have been fighting the government now for the better part of 21 years.
So this, we don't know if this is just lip service or if this is really going to be implemented in any way. It seems a little out of control, clearly.
Yeah, it's out of control, and despite President Bashir's statement that he wants these folks disarmed, that says nothing about what to do with the refugee problem. What, do you just leave it all to Chad because they've, you know, crossed an artificial border and they're in another country now? Do you just throw up your hands and say, well, okay, that's your problem?
So once a refugee problem is created, there's no way. Once it exists, then it really becomes, well, who's gonna take care of this problem, which is where, you know, somebody – like the United States could step in and provide some aid, or the UN could step in and provide some aid.
Yeah, and the UN has been apparently quite slow in trying to get getting off the dime in terms of getting that aid to the Sudanese refugees.
The thing it shows is really that this is another casualty of the Bush administration's fixation on Iraq, really, given that they've concentrated so much of their diplomatic efforts on trying to stabilize Iraq and getting the interim government in place and kind of working towards the June 30th handover, that they don't really have any resources or time left to look at what's going on in Darfur. And that's one of the reasons why the UN resolution has been kind of stalling and may yet take weeks, which you go... however many weeks it takes, it's that number of weeks too long.
But
that should have already happened. But the U.S.'s attention is really off this ball.
But you know what? The U.S.'s attention has always been off this ball. They have missed opportunities with Rwanda and there have been slaughters in Africa for years that the U.S. is just completely overlooked as not really being their problem.
Well, remember,
actually, interesting. I was wondering how important an issue this is for the African-American community, because Bush, there's been a lot of talk about how the Bush administration needs to court the African-American vote because it's just so pitifully low, the percentage of African-Americans that vote Republican. Is this not an issue that some pressure can be brought to bear, or is it just so small that people don't pay attention?
Well, the Bush people obviously are not going to pay attention because, as you point out, their attention has been diverted to Iraq.
They don't pay attention to the African Americans in this country.
Actually, forgot. Yeah. This is reality, something the Bush administration never pays attention to.
Well, remember too, this is a 21-year war.
Yeah.
That means it started during Ronald Reagan's presidency.
Right.
The late sainted Ronald Reagan's presidency.
The late Ronald Reagan deity.
There have been three, four presidents who have had an opportunity to do something about this, and nothing has yet been done.
But that must be partly because public opinion doesn't pressure anybody to do it. They feel there are no consequences or there's no upside to paying attention to it.
But people don't know about it either. I mean, these kind of things go on in the world all the time, and Americans can barely see past their own front door. They can barely see past their television. They can barely inform themselves about regular news in this country.
Right. This has been an issue. There have been kind of picture stories and alarming picture stories in magazines. This has been out at least, in New York Times magazine, big media for, I would say, at least 6 weeks, maybe 2 months now.
Well, I saw a really troubling piece on one of the cable channels where somebody was actually in one of the villages in Darfur and talked about the refugees, talked about some of the things that had happened, showed an 11-year-old kid with a huge laceration that ran from his arm on his left hand, his left arm, all the way across the back of his shoulder. I mean, like an inch-wide laceration, like he had been whiffed or something. I mean, just some incredible stories of devastation, people talking about family members being killed, all that. We're going to tell you what you can do about the crisis in the Sudan.
Yeah, right after this, and we've got the Liberal Agenda coming up, and we've got big guests coming up in the next couple hours. So I want you to stay here on Air America.
Huge.
Fifty-three past the hour. Mark Maron on Mornings Edition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. MorningsEdition.com. Welcome aboard. Here we go. What are you holding there? Are you going to give that information?
We have to give out the information. If you want to encourage the United States government to take immediate action in the Sudan, contact the State Department Sudan Desk 202-647-4597. 202-647-4597. Or the U.S. Mission to the UN, USA@UN.INT. USA@UN.INT.
John Kerry says Sudan's western Darfur region demands the world's immediate attention and action. Rampage against defenseless civilians by government-sponsored militias has caused the deaths of as many as 30,000 people, and more than 1 million have been made homeless. The U.S. government estimates that at least 300,000 more are likely to die, and in the worst case, up to 1 million innocent civilians could perish. Now is not the time to debate whether to call this a catastrophe. A genocide. Now is the time for swift and strong action. That is presidential candidate Jim Kerry, the Democrat.
Jim Kerry?
John Kerry.
Jim Kerry was Jim the Kerry. Cable guy.
Jim is when you Jim get Kerry to know him well.
Jim Kerry is now running for president, and it's really great because he does impressions, and he can contort himself in really weird ways, and he's manic depressive, which I think is always an important factor when you're running for office.
Yeah, it's exciting. All those ups and downs. Fun. Yeah.
Speaking of presidents, I watched Clinton last night. I watched him cleverly sell his book.
I didn't watch it. I missed it.
I didn't find it very enlightening. There were moments where, you know, I found myself taken. I like it when he gets mad. I like this whole bit about the right-wing conspiracy being real, because I've always assumed that. And how he is proud that they tried to impeach him, because none of it stuck. He weathered the storm. And when it was all said and done, they had nothing aside from this Monica Lewinsky thing, which he, you know, accepts, admits, and has had to process. But I really like the fact that he believes that they tried to run him out. It cost $70 million to us for them to find out that he had sex with an intern, and they really tried to destroy him politically, which they really didn't succeed in doing.
So I saw him, but it's sorry.
Who is David Dimbleby?
I was about to mention this. Mark said that he likes seeing him angry. David Dimbleby is one of the most revered, experienced, and respected journalists and interviewers at the BBC, and Clinton basically lost his rag with him in an interview that is yet to be broadcast. But he got really angry. He got
about
really
what?
Angry
about the right wing conspiracy.
Because Dimbleby asked him about his He asked him about the his mea culpa over Monica Lewinsky. And you know, I saw Clinton on 60 Minutes last night, and I saw him speak at a big public event for the launching of the Hunting the President movie last week, and he's kind of he's kind of got an act. So it's the same stuff. It's, you know, you're seeing the same stuff on 60 Minutes in the interview.
A politician doing an act?
Isn't that amazing? Staggering, isn't it? But the thing is that Dimbleby pushed him further. He said, well, you know, you say that you're sorry about this and your moral lapse over Monica Lewinsky, and that, you know, you did it because you could. And, you know, is your contrition genuine? And apparently Clinton got really mad.
As he should have.
And the whole... I think it's a legitimate question.
Yeah, I know,
and,
but why push that question? Why not push a question that's interesting? I mean, you know, why don't people let this go already?
I think you're in the place of the viewer. I mean, people want to know, does he really, really mean it?
So if this guy's
it's only a question. All the politician has to say is, yes, it is, and then, you know, move on to the next question.
But people keep pressing him on this, and it's like, you know, enough already. It's just like, that's just, what's his name, Dingleberry, trying to sell television.
I think it's perfectly legitimate.
So there's a liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Get your pen and your notebooks. Here we go. One stage dramatic reading of Clinton's book with Native American drummers, mimes, and graffiti artists. 2, urge local theaters to provide anger counseling after showings of Fahrenheit 9/11. 3, celebrate summer solstice. Replace winter hemp parka with summer hemp sarong. 4, buy tickets for Madonna's summer tour, but only because of her shrewd political insights. There you go. 5, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Wouldn't it be nice if we all had fins? Yay! We're going in. Take a dip. Here we go. Back to the water.
There you go. Now, listen.
Yes, sir.
That name is Dimbleby, Dingleberry.
I'm sorry.
Okay. He seems like a nice enough guy. Anyway, there's so much more to come in the next hour of Morning's Edition. Will an anonymous book blow the whistle on the war on terror? Plus, Mark Maron's Dream Diary and the Presidential Daily Briefing. Stay tuned to Air America Radio.
Mark Maron here along with Sue Ellicott and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning. It's the first day of summer. How was Father's Day for President Bush and his non-heavenly father? Plus, I'll tell you all about the insane dream I had this weekend, and we're unleashing a brand new comedy item. And we've now got a blog at morningsedition.com. And we'll take your email. It's sedition@airamericaradio.com. You know, the blog, I'm reading the blog. It's very exciting. It's like it's being like directly in touch with you folks out there immediately. Not on the email. I can't do the email. But the blog, I mean, I have to have the email filtered.
To take all the complimentary stuff out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's all I do. Yeah, I sort through it just to get the hate.
He feeds on hate, ladies and gentlemen.
Get me all worked up.
Yeah.
Some guy writes on the blog, Mark, can you please talk about the World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7 being demolished not by fuel fire? That is a lie. The buildings came down exactly like a conventional demolition, which would mean explosive charges for an uncanny, symmetrical, and instant dissolving of all structure. You are so smart. Please respond to this. Thank you, Marco. Marco, I may be smart, but I tend to like it with the conspiracy theories. If you get me going, the problem with the conspiracy theory like that is it's already been politicized. You know, the 9/11 was already the idea that it was done. It was allowed to happen, or it was a political move. I mean, that would have happened either way. You know, whatever happened. And speculating like this, I had a guy come up to me the other day. We were talking about the beheading of Paul Johnson on Friday or Saturday over the weekend. And this guy came up to me. He lives downstairs from me. He's like, you know, I don't know, man. This is pretty suspicious. I think maybe the secret operations of the CIA had something to do with that. And then he sort of asked, like, well, why? I mean, to what end, really? I mean, the thing about conspiracy theory thinking is that it's not really thinking. It feels like thinking, but it's something people do in place of actually investigating the truth. And I've heard this thing about the demolition, but I also...
Me too.
That it was timed like that. But, I mean, that does not dismiss the fact that two planes flew into the places and that the weight of the top of the building... I've read both. I've read that the demolition conspiracy, which is almost unprovable, but I've also read structural analysis that said because of the weight of the top, there was no other way for them to fall. I mean, I've heard both sides of that. And, you know, depending on your method of speculating, if you want to speculate towards a conspiracy, then it's much more exciting because then you get to fight for secret wisdom. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like when somebody offers you another logical thing, you can go, dude, I mean, I got a guy that I talked to that he knows a guy that's from the place, and he's pretty sure he saw some guy go in there with the remote control. And I've got no problem with that, but if I let myself fall into that type of thinking, you know, within days I will be in my apartment with charts and diagrams. My entire place will be covered with numbers. I'll be reading the Kabbalah. I'll be, you know, sourcing, you know, Nostradamus, and also sort of, you know, reading, like, you know, reports on the Trilateral Commission, the Rosicrucians, the Knights of Malta, and the Freemasons. And, you know, I've been there before, and it's harder for me to get into that tunnel without drugs.
No, you so, don't.
But I'm not going
to. No kidding.
I'm not going to disregard what this guy's saying. Obviously, the possibility is out there, and obviously, you know, that type of information and conspiracy thinking can only support what I believe is true: is that this administration is secretive, devious, and not without and completely without shame, and completely capable of letting things happen in order to further their agenda.
I never thought. I really thought I was the only one that had heard that death. You know, the charge. You know, somebody had put explosive charges at the base of the World Trade.
Oh, yeah.
I thought I was the only one that heard that story.
Right? Oh no, it's out there. It's out there in the sort of the marginal world of the conspiracy thinkers and the blogs. And
yes.
it is relevant only in the sense that I completely support conspiracy theories and in insane speculation if it is against this administration. I completely support that. I can't prove it. I can't validate it. But in my head, it is a form of protest that if it makes sense to you, go with it and mobilize it and make other people think that way so they all vote against this douchebag that's in office.
Now, do you want to find out something or let me run some stuff by you?
Truth?
No. I want to run some stuff by you and see if this works for you.
Okay.
Okay? There's a book that's getting ready to come out.
Okay.
It's coming out next month.
Mm-hmm.
It is written by a senior United States intelligence official who was at one point central in the hunt for Osama bin Laden. That book will assert that the West is losing the war on terror, and it is your boy, George W. Bush's fault.
Absolutely.
Now, he is the intelligence official is known only as Anonymous. The book is called Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. It says the war in Iraq played directly into the hands of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. The book says Al-Qaeda is more focused than it was 3 years ago, and that it will soon procure weapons of mass destruction and try to use them.
Oh, the dirty bomb scenario really creeps me out. And we knew this, too, from the 2003-2004 International Institute of Strategic Studies survey, was that, you know, after we went into Iraq, after George Bush invaded Iraq because he could, the U.S. occupation of Iraq, it brought 1,000, at least 1,000 foreign Islamic fighters into the country, you know, within months. Bam! Great! A place for us to work out.
The timing of this book is interesting, isn't it? I mean, the author of this, even though he's unnamed, he's kind of like the Joe Klein of the intelligence community, and Joe Klein who wrote Primary Colors about the inside track on.
Well, Chiffon Breath is right. It might actually be Dick Cheney. Chiffon Breath was somebody who called us. I guess that's her blog name, and she said that these guys are trying to get caught.
It's an interesting timing with this book. That, I mean, so far all the other books that we've had have been mainly by kind of frustrated kind of ex-administration officials, and the fact that, you know, the fact that this is somebody in the intelligence community suggests that it's, you know, it represents really significantly what a vast chunk of that community actually kind of feels about this. And I think there are growing signs that the counter-terrorist professionals subscribe to the very same view.
I knew this. Like, I knew a friend of mine. Here's a little conspiracy.
Uh-oh, here we go.
My buddy Paul in Los Angeles, he's a sound guy, you know, and he told me that his father was ex-intelligence, and that, you know, the word in the ex-intelligence community was that this president is horrendous, and that, you know, that he's manipulating intelligence, and, you know, he's an enemy of the intelligence community. I mean, and he told me that was 2 years ago, dude.
How long do you think it is before this guy who wrote this book gets outed? I mean, Klein, it took, what, about 3 months?
It was some months. I think it went too far. People clearly, if you read the reports on this book, people clearly know who he is. I mean, Peter Bergen, who I think, did we have him as a guest before, who wrote two books about bin Laden and Al-Qaeda?
I think we did talk to Peter Bergen. Never did.
Okay, well, we should. At some point, we will, okay? We'll tease Peter Bergen. That he, you know, he says that in The Guardian that the author's views represent an amped-up version of what is emerging as a consensus among intelligence counter-terrorist professionals.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he doesn't hide, this guy, that his loathing for the Bush White House.
They'll know
absolutely
who it is.
Know, and I think that, you know, I reckon it'll come out within weeks.
Well, you know, he also is saying that Al-Qaeda may reward Bush. You mentioned this earlier, Mark.
Yeah.
With some form of strike, a dirty bomb or whatever, that would be aimed at trying to keep him. Now, why would they try and keep a guy in office who is still fighting with the September 11th commission, you know, this war of words back and forth over whether or not, A, there was some link between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. I mean, why would they try and protect the guy? It seems counterintuitive, but this book seems to believe that there is a reason why bin Laden wants to keep this guy in office.
Well, I think that just because of how stubborn Bush is and his relentless, you know, desire to continue to, you know, to not honor anything that they say or even negotiate with them at all, is really bonding the extremist Muslim world together.
Okay.
And that, because, like, well, Paul Johnson, well, this was, you know, this guy was killed. They're now getting their message out in videos.
Yeah.
They're killing Americans in the most heinous, primitive, barbaric way. And because of this president, people see those videos who may not have been part of this and go, wow, these people are really doing something. I want to be part of this struggle.
You know, as an American, I have to say that the killing, the first thing I thought
awful.
Of, yeah, it, I mean, it really does suck. I don't care what your ideology is or whatever, it sucks.
And there's another one now. There's somebody else that's
South
in
Korea.
Captivity. We'll talk to you. Yeah, we'll talk about that after. We'll take your calls also, 866-303-2270. Yeah? Okay, Air America Radio, come back. Past the hour. Good morning. It's morning's edition. I'm Mark Maron here with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott on Air America Radio. We're blogging at morningsedition.com. We're
Bring
taking emails. Sedition at AOL. Sedition at AirAmericaRadio.com. We're taking your calls.
We've been bought by Time Warner already. Amazing.
Don't scare people, will you?
866-303-2270. We're taking calls. 866-AAR0. We'll talk
303-AAR0.
Yeah, we'll talk to you about whatever you want to talk about. Right now, I'd like to talk to my therapist, but I can't, so I'm going to talk to you. Here's my dream diary for today. I'm a matador, El Marco from Albuquerque. I'm wearing a ridiculous sparkly gold jacket that's way too short and the world's tightest pants. Not getting any circulation down there, if you know what I mean. There's this little squeaking sound when I walk. Anyway, the arena is filled with 50,000 adoring fans, and they all have guitars. Everyone is strumming, strumming, strumming. There's lots of flamenco. Opposite me is the bull, George W. Bull, a snorting, smirking, unapologetic beast who is pawing at the sand and promising tax cuts. My eyes flash, my nostrils flare. Who is this sweaty Toro to taunt the magnificent tight trousers of El Marco? I brandish my sword and I march toward him, though I decide against the arrogant laugh and the head toss combo. George W. Bull lowers his lying, privileged head and begins to charge. The guitar strumming swells to unbearable volume, preparing for the clash of the predator and the prey. The air fills with blood and tequila. At the moment of unbearable climax, El Marco raises his sword and prepares to thrust. The crowd gasps. Just then, the bull turns into my dead cat, Butch. The guitars stop.
Not her
again. Butch! Butch, get out of the way! There's this giant bull coming! Butch looks up at me and shakes her head. Mark, why must you indulge in the theater of rank barbarism? Much as you may abhor the current regime, bloodshed will only beget more bloodshed. As Thomas Merton said, violence can begin only when thought and rational communication have broken down. Isn't it embarrassing enough to be seen in public wearing those pants? I put down my sword and gaze around at the crowd. I say, hey, anybody here from Seville? Great town, Seville, but the traffic, huh? Forget about it. I do a two-hour set that kills, and they shower me with roses and virgins. For an encore, I split my pants. They give me a sitcom on Telemundo called El Marco Loco. I woke up, and my bed was filled with the Sons of Cortez.
Mm.
How do you like that?
Yeah.
I always like seeing Butch.
She doesn't like being disturbed from her idol, though. She's kind of an ornery cat.
She had something to say. You know, Butch shows up, man. Butch shows up in the dream. She shows up in the... What, are you kidding me? Call us! 866-303-2270. 866-303-AARZ. We don't want to call anymore, Mark.
We're blogging. Never mind. Mark, I want to ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
You and Sue.
Yeah.
I had heard a conversation over the weekend, because I eavesdrop every now and then.
Yeah.
And it was in the wake, obviously, of the murder of Paul Johnson.
Yeah.
And, of course, there is now a South Korean who is at risk, they've threatened to kill as well. But, you know, a couple of guys were talking, and they just said, look, why don't we just withdraw completely from the Middle East, take everybody, every American out of Saudi Arabia, get out of Iraq, leave the Middle East to themselves.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
And they went into this whole thing, you know, they live in the 12th century, let them do whatever, you know, let them do whatever it is they're going to do. We don't have to be involved. Now, of course, the X factor there is the oil.
Right.
And the fact that America is dependent, some say overly dependent on fossil fuels. Question, do you think we could, if there was a serious effort to develop alternatives to fossil fuels, in other words, you don't have to wait 5 years to get a Toyota Prius.
Yeah.
Do you think America could legitimately withdraw from the Middle East?
Only if we stay obese. Let me explain. There's this new fossil fuel. It's a non-fossil fuel that they're running cars on leftover restaurant grease.
Yeah.
So as long as people in this country continue to eat things brought, you know, fried in fat, deep fat, potentially, you know, the best. Keep eating the fries, keep eating the Chinese food, keep eating all that stuff, and we can detach from fossil fuels and foreign oil. So I'm telling you fat people out there, keep going, get fatter, eat those fries and free us from fossil fuels.
Sue, your thoughts?
He took the words right out of my mouth. I don't know. You'd have to get Europe and Asia signed on to this obesity program too, because it's their problem as well. I mean, it's not just America that's gobbling up oil and is dependent on Middle East oil. It's Europe and it's Asia.
But we can
and
get
Asia,
so
China's
fat.
Expanding. Well, everybody should get into the fat program together then.
China, fatten up. Europe, get fatter.
Forget Atkins. Go Fatkins.
But I mean, is this why they got the South Korean? I mean, is it because it's now Asia's problem too?
I think they probably got the South Korean because they could get him because he was there, and you know they can put pressure on another government to say, you know, put your troops out or you know take your peacekeepers. And I can't remember what role the South Koreans are there.
There's like 700
troops.
They are sending some troops.
Okay,
Is that many?
It could be as many as a few thousand, but they want them out. I don't know. I believe that they'll get whomever from whichever country they can get.
Mm. But the ones that the Americans were pretty specific. It seemed like the Nick Berg in Iraq thing had something to do with him being Jewish and having an Israeli passport. There's also conspiracy theories around that he was perhaps, say, some sort of agent of some sort.
And Johnson was an engineer for Lockheed, and they developed the helicopters that are shooting missiles into Iraqi or into villages and not Iraq.
And a lot of other nationalities were released. Yeah. They released a lot of people, so they're being sort of specific. And as arcane as these cultures may be, like you said, they're living in the 12th century. They are becoming very savvy. They all have cell phones. They all have computers. They're doing, you know, clever things and sort of as far as avoiding identification on computers.
And they all watch Al Jazeera.
But that was an interesting conversation that you overheard, because I don't think it's possible to say that you have to get all the troops out, if only because they weren't really invited in the first place. I mean, they came in, you know, on their own volition, on the government's volition, and they have to finish the job. It would look really bad if they all got out. What the debate should shift to, I think, is the number of civilians working for places such as Halliburton who have also been targets. There have been, you know, dozens of people working for, you know, Halliburton who have been killed.
Independent contractors in general.
And they should, I think the interesting question is whether civilians should go and work for those tax-free, incredibly high-income jobs in Saudi Arabia and live in those compounds, you know, between these astroturf swimming pools, their own schools, their own shopping malls, sort of like mini America or mini Britain or mini whichever country you belong to, almost like sort of kind of a Vegas version of the United States or Europe behind walls, whether people should go and take those jobs and have this ridiculous distinction between Saudi Arabian society and Western culture. I mean, people need to be aware of the risks involved.
Well, I think they're pretty aware.
Well, no, but
balance it out. People do things even though there are risks because, you know, money warps the decisions people make.
The weird thing about Paul Johnson, that whole situation is they think that some of the Saudi security people were involved.
That there are sympathizers, Al-Qaeda sympathizers
within
Saudi security that actually, and by the way, this is the Al-Qaeda cell that's saying this. They are saying that they got both police cars and police uniforms.
We've got operatives on the inside.
Yes, and they set up a fake checkpoint on June 12th and abducted Paul Johnson. And by the way, targeted him very specifically. By the way, we've just gotten word that a military judge has declared the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq a crime scene and has ordered it not to be destroyed, as President Bush had offered to do.
Can't erase it. Can't erase it. We got Roscoe in New Paltz. What's up, buddy?
Hey.
You were asking if we could just pull out of the Middle East and let them to themselves. If we had a Manhattan Project-style project like we had during World War II for alternative energy, we could. And Carter started it when he put when he had all the tax cuts and he put the solar panels on the White House, and Reagan took them off.
Oh, so you're saying
what he's saying is a Manhattan-style project. No, a Manhattan-style project. What he's saying is you take the best minds in the country, you give them the best resources,
let them work the angles, crunch the numbers,
and develop an actual alternative, whether it be vegetable oil or whatever, to fossil fuel.
Instead of putting it all into military technology. There are people that believe that there are those plans out there already. Are we going to take more calls on the other side?
We should, maybe.
Oh, we got a guest. There's no reason to take
calls.
Sorry, you guys. Call back later. Blog it up.
Well, there is this question, though. I mean, there are people, I believe, who do think that America ought to, and this speaks to something Sue was talking about earlier. The people that I overheard talking made no distinction between U.S. troops in Iraq and people working in Saudi Arabia.
Their thing was,
Americans get out.
Right.
Right.
But, you know, that's bad for the civilians that they've been kind of lumped into the same category.
The only way out is to go, I'm a Muslim! Don't do it!
Doesn't work. That's how the British cameraman got almost killed.
Almost.
Oh, yes. Almost. That's true. When we come back, author Peter Schweizer deconstructs the Bush's father and son, plus the countdown to democracy when Air America Radio continues.
Good morning, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley, Steve Olicott on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. You can go to our new blog at morningsedition.com. You can email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. You could come to see me tomorrow night at the Comics for Kerry.
Yeah, yeah.
The campaign fundraiser in support of John Kerry's presidential campaign. It's tomorrow night at Caroline's Comedy Club, 7 o'clock p.m. Belzer's going to be there, Eddie Brill, Jim David, Dean Edwards, Susie Essman, Drew Frazier, Jim Gaffigan, who will be in studio tomorrow, Judy Gold, and myself. General seating is only $9,000 for a ticket.
That's all?
That's $150 general admission. But, you know, it goes to the Kerry campaign, so, you know, you come get some laughs and go, but what about my money? Oh, okay, it's good.
You get a drink for that? Come on.
Right now, we have a guest on the phone who I'd like to do some justice in introducing. Yesterday was Father's Day. This guy has written a book called The Bushes, A Portrait of a Dynasty. He knows a lot about, you know, why our president is so screwed up, perhaps, because he wrote about the relationship between George W. and George H.W. Bush. Please welcome Peter Schweizer to the show. Peter, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you guys?
I'm pretty good. So Father's Day, do you think George H.W. got the loving, adoring call from his son?
Well, I'm sure they talked.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that's so interesting about him is that they're very different people, different temperaments, different attitudes, and yet one of the reasons that the Bush family is so successful is that there is that sense that not everybody has to walk in lockstep, so they have different politics and different attitudes and temperaments, but they still, you know, cooperate and love each other.
Didn't George W. try to kick his dad's ass?
He did indeed back in 1973, Christmas of 1973. He had gone out drinking, came back late, and ran into the neighbor's trash can and dragged it down the street a little bit until he got to his parents' house. And his father met him on the doorstep and said, you know, we need to talk right now.
Yeah.
And George W. said, let's do it right now, mano a mano.
Yeah, and what happened, though? I mean, I always hear that part of the story, but whose butt got kicked?
Well, I tell you, you know what happened was it was Jeb, who's even bigger than George W., who intervened and made sure that nothing happened.
Jeb broke it up?
It never quite happened.
So Jeb was like the diplomatic one, the more sort of codependent. Hey, don't hurt each other.
Well, who do you think would have won?
It's interesting because he's younger by about 6 years, but he's a big guy. You know, he's 6'3", 6'4". Even though he was younger, he was able to get into the middle and break him up.
Wasn't Jeb the sort of selected, didn't they think he was going to be the politician, the success story? Wasn't George W. always sort of like the renegade?
He was. That's right. I mean, if you look at Jeb and George W., their story is the story of the prodigal son. You know, George W. is the prodigal. You know, when his dad ran for a political office, it was usually Jeb who was the one that showed up early and stayed late at the campaign. And, you know, then the turning point came in 1994. Everybody was expecting Jeb to run for governor. They'd thought of him in terms of political office for a long time. He was a serious one, and at the same time, George W. announced he was running for governor of Texas. And a lot of people thought that was a mistake. They didn't think that you know, he'd be successful against Ann Richards. And lo and behold, there was this complete reversal of fortune. Jeb actually lost and George W. won. So, you know, the fate of the dynasty, they thought it was going to rest on Jeb, but it ended up resting on his older brother.
How'd they react to that when George surprised them and won?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting when you look during that campaign, most of the time that Barbara and George Sr. Were out campaigning, they were doing it for Jeb. They spent most of their time campaigning for Jeb and raising money for Jeb. But when the reversal took place, you know, that's the thing about the Bushes. I mean, they are constantly evolving and constantly changing. Prescott Bush was this moderate senator from Connecticut, George H.W. Bush, more conservative Texan, and now you have Jeb and George W. who are even more conservative. And so they have this ability to adapt and change, which makes them different from other dynasties like the Kennedys. And I think that kind of protean nature allows them to be more successful and more flexible.
And change for the worse, though.
Pete Schweitzer, co-author of The Bushes, Portrait of a Dynasty, or Dynasty, as I would say.
Dynasty.
What do you think is the most sort of pivotal thing in Bush's relationship with the rest of his family, and how does that play out and affect what kind of presidency he has?
Well, I think what's interesting about George W. Bush in relation to his father is that he really doesn't model himself politically on his father. It's much more he models himself on Reagan.
That's got to hurt.
And I think that, again, reflects in part the fact that, you know, in the Republican Party, it's really Reagan who is idolized. And the father is certainly respected and liked within the party, but it's Reagan who's idolized. And so when you come to a lot of issues, whether it's foreign policy or domestic issues, you know, people wonder why isn't, you know, George W. like his father. The simple fact is that the model is Reagan. It's not his own man.
So you're saying that he wants to be idolized like Reagan. He doesn't want to be disrespected like his dad. He's looking for something more.
Yeah, I mean, I think anybody who goes into politics who wants to be president of the United States, I mean, you know, we're going to see that, I think, with Clinton's memoirs. I mean, everybody that goes into the White House wants to have a legacy that is long remembered and wants to transform their party and you know, change direction in the country. That tends to be what most people go into the presidency for. And, you know, there's no question that it's the same with this president. The father was much more, you know, as we describe in the book, was much more the ideology of friendship. I mean, he was somebody who was friends with Dan Ross and Kowski. He had a lot of friends on the Democratic side of the aisle. And he really grew up in that era of World War II of consensus politics.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, you know, we sort of all work together, and if we work together, we can, you know, overcome our differences and come to some kind of consensus view. George W., you know, of course, his experience is much more 1960s in Yale, and, you know, he grew up politically, even though he said he wasn't that interested in politics when he was young, he did pay attention, and he saw the success of Reagan. He read Barry Goldwater's book, Conscience of a Conservative, and I think out of that experience and out of his, you know, seeing the experiences of his father's and his limited success in the presidency, adopted the Reagan mantle as the route to go.
Well, I'm glad to hear he at least did read one book. Peter Schweitzer, let me ask you this. How much should we look for George H.W. Bush on the campaign trail with his son as we head to the run-up to November?
I think we'll see him as much as George W. Wants to see him, and so I think that will be quite a bit. But that said, I mean, there are a lot of differences there in terms of, temperaments and approach and attitude. One of the Bush family members, told us that the temperament within the family is pretty well known, that George H.W. Bush is strictly forgive and forget. Barbara Bush is never forgive and never forget. And George W. Bush is forgive but remember. And I think that is the temperament in the way that they deal with politics.
So hey, Peter?
I think we'll see him on the campaign trail, and I think that he will help out. I think we'll probably see the mother even more because George W. Bush is, his mother's son.
Peter Schweitzer.
His outlook and his approach to things.
We hang out a minute. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but we got to go. I want to ask you a question. Will you address Prescott Bush's relationship with the Nazis after this break?
Yeah, sure.
Well, thanks a lot. So we'll be back. When we come back, we will tell you about the crisis that's putting thousands of lives at stake and what you can do about it here on Air America. We'll also talk more with Peter Schweitzer. Before past the hour, Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott. We have Peter Schweitzer, co-author of The Bush's Portrait of a Dynasty, on the phone. You're listening to Air America Radio. It is now time for our countdown to democracy. As the deadline for handover to power to the Iraqis approaches, we'd like to explore various issues and opportunities the Iraqis and Americans will face. Today's issue is remaining united. Leaders of Iraq. It's crucial for a developing democracy to remain united. When one group wants to go off and form its own country, it creates hostility. Yes, exactly. Now, your Kurds have been treated, well, I'll tell you, like crap for a long time, okay? All right. From around 700 AD, to be exact, they've been treated like crap. So that naturally, they might want to distance themselves a bit from your new Sunni Shiite government in Baghdad. They might even want to form their own country. Don't let them. We failed to nip this secession thing in the bud and had to fight a long, ugly civil war. You don't want that. No, seriously. Seriously. Stop it. You don't. Ever since we've had to placate the dissenting half of the country by electing a series of feckless southern presidents. So pretend that you care about the Kurds. Let them wear their stuff, have their little holidays, and whatever you do, don't make fun of their accents. People hate that. All right, well, look, good luck and God bless. This is day 9. All right, in our countdown to democracy, live free or die. All right, I can't. What am I, 7? All right, Peter Schweitzer. There is a genocide that is unfolding now in Sudan, and the Nazis, of course, sort of invented it. And there has been, allegations, which are true, that Prescott Bush, George W. Bush's grandfather, made a lot of money off the Nazis by supporting them financially when most of America pulled out, right?
Well, I researched that. We started working on this book back in 1999. I researched that extensively, and there's just a lot of myth-making there.
Uh-huh.
The reality is that Brown Brothers Harriman, which is the investment banking firm where he was a partner, and where where Burt Walker, that would be the grandfather of former President Bush, was up until 1930. But those portfolios were really handled by Averell Harriman, who sort of saw himself as a Secretary of State in the making. And
uh-huh.
If you look through the records of all the meetings that are available, not only, for example, with Nazi Germany, but also with Soviet Russia, it's really Averell Harriman that handles that portfolio. Those relationships developed 5-6 years before Prescott Bush joined the firm. And we know from the records that are available, for example, like the Union Banking Corporation, that mm-hmm. of the 5,000 shares that were issued of that company, that's the company that everybody looks to where the Trading with the Enemies Act was sort of issued. Of those 5,000 shares, Prescott Bush had one share, as did all the other directors of Brown Brothers Harriman. The Harriman family owned over 3,000 of those shares.
Now, that was the Averell Harriman that later became governor of New York?
That's correct. And his brother Roland, who really owned the bulk of the money in the firm. So, you know,
so what was that stock in?
That, you know, that is abhorrent that a lot of other investment banking firms were doing in the 1930s. But I think really what's happening is that, you know, people are taking something that occurred where Prescott Bush really handled the domestic portfolio. I mean, he was cutting deals with what would become CBS, with Dresser Industries, all these domestic companies. He had really nothing at all to do with the international portfolio, but it's a convenient hook that a lot of people try to use to convince them that somehow he was sympathetic or tied with the Nazis.
So you're saying that to connect Prescott Bush with the Nazis is sort of like connecting Saddam Hussein with Al-Qaeda in a way.
Well, I think, you know, based on the historical one, which is the one I've studied, there's just really no way to link those two on a political level or even on a financial level. I mean, his involvement was entirely with a domestic portfolio. His job at Brown Brothers Harriman was to bring domestic investors in and get them involved in mergers and acquisitions of companies.
Didn't Barbara Bush, we're talking to Peter Schweitzer, co-author of the Bush's Portrait of a Dynasty, or Dynasty, as he says. Didn't Barbara Bush, wasn't she from a banking family as well?
She was from a family, actually. Her father was a publisher of Red Book, the woman's magazine. And so that's what her background was. She had a brother who later became head of E.F. Hutton. But in terms of financial links, you might be thinking of the Walkers, which is the maternal grandmother's side of George H.W. Bush's family.
I want to make them evil. And either when you said when you said Red Book, part of my brain went, that's kind of evil. Red Book's evil, right? It's red. It's, you know, it misleads women. It's evil. They're connected to evil. Hold on.
Barbara Bush tells the story that when she went to Smith College, and then when they moved down to Texas, when she married George H.W. Bush, she would tell people that her father owned Red Book, and people thought that somehow it was a communist influence.
So, exactly.
Final quick question, Peter Schweitzer. I'm not to use too many Godfather analogies here, but if Jeb Bush is the more successful of the Bush brothers, and perhaps could be likened to Michael, would that make George W. Fredo?
You know, what's interesting about Jeb is that, people, I think, are assuming that George W. Bush win or lose, that Jeb probably does not have presidential ambitions, just because that would make a third Bush to be president. But when we interviewed family members, I mean, they all indicated that Jeb Bush's plans are to run in 2008. Win or lose. I would say that at least within the Republican Party, the way that the party is structured, the fact that the Bushes have this financial network and this volunteer network, I think it's his to lose. I mean, I think, people should expect to see George Jeb Bush running for president and perhaps even getting the Republican nomination in 2008. And the dynasty may or may not be extended at that point.
But that's only if this President Bush doesn't make an amendment to the Constitution that makes him president for life. Peter Schweitzer, it's been great talking to you. Good fun. The Bushes, Portrait of a Dynasty. Available at bookstores now. We'll be back on Air America Radio with the new job listing. We went through the classifieds yesterday. We got a new job listing. Ooh. For people who are interested. Dueling Clintons might be here. William from Chappaqua and Bill from Harlem.
Uh-oh.
Come back. We're having a good time. Good morning, it's Monday. Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott and Air America Radio. We're blogging at morningsedition.com. We're emailing at sedition@airamericaradio.com. And we're offering you some help out there. We know a lot of people out there are out of work and spent your Sunday leafing through the want ads or monster.com. We want to help out, be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So here's the very first Morning Sedition Help Wanted listing. Major party presidential candidate seeks running mate. Applicant should be charismatic without overshadowing, rather dour supervisor. Detailed knowledge of foreign and economic affairs, a plus. Ideal candidate will be from Ohio, Michigan, Florida, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Missouri, and Louisiana. And, Maine wouldn't hurt either. Do not apply if you've had any of the following. Verifiable extramarital affairs, undocumented nannies, or electroshock therapy. Minorities are encouraged to apply, but let's be realistic, okay? We cannot offer health care at this time, but you should be willing to work to change that. Note, this is an unpaid temporary position until early November, possible permanent status at that time. That's our Help Wanted segment. I'm not sure the music really works. It was sort of distracting, a little weird. We thought, because that's a chain gang.
Yeah, it is.
So it's sort of a working out. African chant.
No, it's an old chain gang song.
That's a chain gang song.
We are now, I watched the Bill Clinton. The other thing I want to say before we go into the talking about Bill Clinton briefly is that Marco, one of our blog guys, was talking about conspiracies, and that Prescott Bush Nazi connection has really a blown up mythic conspiracy.
Yeah.
And Schweitzer sort of, you know, laid it to rest to some degree. I mean, clearly, you know, Prescott was involved, but he said it wasn't like Prescott was calling Hitler.
And urban saying, legend.
Dude, how much do you need?
Yeah.
Prescott wasn't like, you know, Adolf, buddy. So I saw Clinton on TV last night. And, you know, I wish he would have gotten madder about some stuff. I really felt like he was just selling the book. Oh, wait, there he is. No, William from Chappaqua always calls in. Like, didn't he have anything else to do? How are you, President Clinton? Nice to talk to you.
Good morning. And in my own defense, I have to say, I always invite camera crews with me to my mama's grave.
But you were just shamelessly selling that book, weren't you?
Well, I think someone else can answer
that. All right, there's Bill.
Better.
All right, Bill in Harlem.
Hey,
what's up, buddy?
Hey, my man.
Come on, man.
Who are you calling shameless, Mark? Come on, buddy.
You,
everything
man.
In this
you.
Life is for sale.
Yeah, but you
it's
know,
all for sale.
But we wanted to hear a little more. We wanted to hear some details.
Oh, come on. Y'all are just waiting around for the dirty stuff, and you got to just buy the book. Buy my book. Buy it now. Buy my book. Come to my house, and I'll read it to you.
See,
you know I'll do that.
Here you go again. Don't you think this is going to undermine your credibility is
that's William's job, man. That's on the other side of the fence. My job is all about Elvis, baby. All about Elvis.
I understand.
I will read to you, honey.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for calling, Presidents Bill and William.
All
I
right,
appreciate
man.
You being here, you guys.
Don't go on British TV anytime soon.
Yeah,
we're
that.
Not done yet here on Morning's Edition. Up next, former Clinton Labor Secretary Robert Reich on Bill Clinton's new book and his own, plus Recovery Corner and more, here on Air America Radio.
Hey, I'm Mark Maron with Stu Ellicott and Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning. It's Monday, the first day of summer. I'm going to corner Robert Reich about his buddy Clinton's book peddling spree.
Spree?
I told I'd open it again.
Wow. Maybe I shouldn't try to do this with half a mouthful of bagel. The bagel came. Robert Reich's book, Reason. I just finished it, too. I want to talk to him about that. It changed my life. It's a great book. Hmm. Plus, we're going to corner President Bush and drag him into Recovery Corner. That's coming up. Do we have Recovery Corner today? We do.
Yeah.
Right now, I got Mark Riley. Sue Ellicott is here.
Hey.
Wow, that coffee's kicking in there, Mark.
We've got a blog at morningsedition.com, our new blog, and people are kicking up. Here's a little something from the blog. I must confess, Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. I peed in the kitchen sink this morning because I had to get back to the Morning Sedition blog and get a fresh cup of coffee at the same time. I knew my wife was still asleep. I did it because I could.
Oh, no.
You guys.
Wait a minute. We're causing people
to... Oh, come on. Just because you can't pee in the sink without climbing on the counter doesn't
bet?
Mean you
want
got to judge.
You mean
judge this guys.
We got people peeing
could.
In sinks now? Is that the point of this blog?
No, there's a lot of stuff going on. It's all pretty exciting. We've got conspiracy theorists. Marco, the conspiracy theorist, is kicking in with some more stuff about when he thinks the October surprise is going to happen. I've also got some other business here I need to talk about. Comics for Carrie tomorrow night, June 22nd, 7 o'clock p.m., featuring me, Richard Belzer, Eddie Brill, Jim David, Susie Essman from Curb Your Enthusiasm, Jim Gaffigan, very funny man, will be in the studio tomorrow. Also, Dick Cheney, the evil satanic master of all things.
He's the MC?
Yeah, Dick Cheney's going to show up.
Hello, I'm Dick.
Watch this. Watch the horns come out.
That
Look
would be
at
worth $9,000, actually.
Yeah, it would be. I'm here for Carrie, like the rest of you.
We could chip in a dollar from all sorts of listeners to send somebody from Air America along to see the horns emerge from Dick Cheney.
Mm. Yeah. I imagine it's going to happen. I made a bet with Colin Quinn. I'm going to also be on Tough Crowd tomorrow night. I'm going to do both those things.
Wow, you're going to divide yourself in half?
He's like the dueling Marins.
I'll do Tough Crowd early, and then I'll cut over and do the Carrie thing.
Do the Carrie thing late.
And I'll try and get in bed by 9.
Ooh.
My big night. My wife's in town. Wow, this is going to be a big week.
She's going to be keeping you awake, I guess.
A big, exhausting wake. Week. Yes, that's been happening. It's all good. Everything is good. Everything's functioning properly, and things are moving forward.
That's
with me.
Wonderful.
In the land of Mark, over there, within the boundaries of Astoria, Queens, in my land, in my apartment, things are being done and taken care of. Financially, everything's good. The people are fed. Everyone is sated.
Sated.
Oh, okay. Not Satan. He's out there.
No, sated. I know exactly what he's talking about.
We had a couple of Satan moments while being sated, but that's to be expected. There's nothing wrong with a little evil with the sex,
that's
is there?
Right. Well, all men know what the word sated means. It kind of is like synonymous.
What, women
with,
don't?
Well, it's synonymous with spent. And see, women may not get spent the same way men do. Men are no good once we're spent, I can tell you that now. We just got to sit there.
They have new pills for that now. You don't ever have to be spent. You could be up all the time.
Wow. It's not a powder anymore.
I didn't do that. I mean, are we going to do this? Is it? What is it? And it's not a powder anymore. That powder did nothing for helping that.
You
could be up for 20 hours trying to make the other thing work. Yeah, that was a good time. I know we'll do it. Please persevere with me. Please. I know I'm sweating and I look desperate, but please, it's going to happen.
But you don't.
That
like,
was the 80s.
You don't float through
and
things like
90s.
Like you kind of do when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning every morning for 2 months. You know, that sort of floaty, spacey feeling.
Oh, dude, it took me years to appreciate a sunrise without thinking like, oh, no, there's my day.
I am you know so, what I mean? Like, I'm sorry I missed out on that.
What?
You didn't do anything fun?
I did not do that stuff.
You didn't do any blow?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
You know, frankly, from your kind of reminiscing, it doesn't sound as though I kind of really, on the balance of it all, missed out on very much.
Yeah, but the thing you missed out on was that moment of confidence, of complete, like, I am the king
the
of
world.
All things.
Yep.
Look at me go. People should bow to me. And then there's a sort of like, man, I'm running out. I'm running out of the people should bow to me stuff.
Okay,
Where's my little package of like, oh, no, why do I hate?
Really? I don't know many women who need the I am the king of the world thing.
Really? You don't?
No.
You haven't met my wife.
Well, you know what?
And I got a feeling that you've got a little king of the world in you too, Sue. Yeah. And if you say you don't, you're lying. I can feel it.
Well, lucky for you, it's boxed up somewhere.
I'm
lucky
know.
For everybody.
I'm not sure.
Do you ever open that box to anybody?
I don't know.
Is that the secret box of power that you're hiding from the world?
She could play the queen of all media role, I think, pretty, She can do it. It might take a little work, but she could do it.
It's maybe a queen thing, not a king thing, don't you think, Riley?
Well, that's what I said, queen of all media.
Absolutely.
But listen.
Queen Sue! We must all bow to Queen Sue.
No, I'm a nice democratic queen. I'm like the queen of the Netherlands. I go around on my bicycle.
Well, queen...
I'm a modern queen.
I'm starting to think that whole thing is a gimmick. It's a sham. It's hiding something darker and more insidious.
Don't you impugn the queen of the Netherlands like that, Mark.
I'm not buying the old bike and scooter thing anymore.
Gee, I thought the queen of the Netherlands was Ruud van Nistelrooy. But that's a whole other story.
So who's this Wayman guy?
Anyway.
Who is this Wayman guy?
The King George of W.
Yes.
George W. Bush.
Yes.
Is he playing into the hands of bin Laden? Is he playing into the hands of Al-Qaeda?
All I know is that he's losing the war on terror. So if that makes logical sense, then he is playing into the hands of bin Laden. If this is part of bin Laden's strategy for him to rally the Islamic radical troops, then
yes.
Bush is doing just that.
Well, a new book says just that. This was written by a senior U.S., not Saudi, not Iraqi, not Iranian, not Pakistani, senior U.S. intelligence official who has really savaged George W. Bush's war on terror and has said essentially that the war in Iraq has hurt this country in ways, and we've said this before, Mark. You said it, Sue. You've said it. I've said it. That this war.
So it must be right.
It must be true. It is going to hurt this country for years and years to come. And, of course, this book, which was written by someone now named Anonymous, who, by the way, was involved in the hunt for Osama bin Laden, a hunt that has thus far been unsuccessful, says that bin Laden is in charge of a much more focused group of terrorist operatives than he was back in 2001.
And they're franchising.
Yeah, and they're moving apparently with impunity between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And there's talk, of course, that and it's interesting how, you know, start reading some of these some of these stories, how information that doesn't get it, by and large, the American people, starts to come forward. For right. example, Musharraf, the president of Pakistan, is not going after many terrorists on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, specifically because he does not want to anger the Pashtun ethnic group that
right.
lives there.
Absolutely.
And does not want to start a war with them that might involve other people throughout Pakistan and might, in fact, end up toppling his government.
So he's got to play it cool. Yeah.
Right. That's what makes this thing so messy, is because Al-Qaeda specifically has not, you know, allied itself with any state, which is another reason why it's just such a load of phoniness that Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda have ties, because they're anti-involvement with any identification with any state. That's what makes it so difficult for state leaders to try, because they're having to play off kind of, you know, tribal stuff and, you know, politics between one country and another. And this is sort of... this is kind of way over the kind of normal framework of how to do things.
Mm-hmm. But they have aligned themselves with Iraq and Saudi Arabia post Bush's invasion of Iraq.
Well, see, now you've got the Saudis in a very peculiar situation as well, where you have the Saudi royal family apparently split in two about how to deal with the terrorist threat inside their own country. That terrorist threat, of course, has taken the life of Paul Johnson, Nicholas Berg, the BBC camera person.
Frank.
And critically injured another BBC camera person, right?
One died and the other was Frank. Yeah, Frank something, I'm
and
sorry.
And they have a South Korean... in custody now. Is that in Saudi? No, it's in Iraq.
Yeah. Actually, the cameraman, Simon Cumbers, died on the scene. Frank Gardner from the BBC is still hospitalized in critical condition.
Right.
And there's a very interesting story that references an article in Foreign Affairs. We'll talk about this a little bit later. That details this split within the Saudi royal family and the implications it has for their war on terror.
Right, and they're vulnerable to democratic forces, too.
Still ahead, the president's palm pilot, Robert Reich, and more right here on Air America Radio. What's going on? 18 after the hour, Mark Maron here on Air America Radio, Mornings Edition with Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott.
Yep.
On the repeats, I don't sound like me.
You don't sound like me.
It's true. You do sound different. You sound kind of, it is mellower.
It's mellower.
You have to up the anger level to sound angry now.
But wait, what do you sound like?
Well,
do you sound the same?
When I heard the show when I was in London last week, you two guys were on and I wasn't, so I couldn't hear me, but both of you sounded different to me.
So clearly we
all sound different.
So we sound, I'm good.
He's confused.
No, I'm not confused.
Okay,
I'm just feeling exasperated because I'm trying to think. Well, I'm like, so we sound different to us right here in the room, but when we listen to it, like, you would probably sound different to me than you sound right now in my head.
Yeah.
All right, let's do the Palm Pilot.
There we go. We just got
this in earlier. All I'm thinking about is, like, what, do I sound like a girl, or do I sound like this?
I shouldn't have ever said
that. Hello, my name is Mark Maron. This is Morning's Edition. What do they do? There's somebody, you know, in post going, let's make them sound nasally and weird. All right, here's the president's schedule for today. 7 o'clock a.m., wake up, stay on message. We won't cut and run. 8 o'clock a.m., cabinet meeting. Topic, cutting and running. 8:30 a.m., meet with speechwriters about replacing the words cut and run. Suggest peace with honor, or here's your freedom, now enjoy your civil war. Or mission accomplished, on to Syria. 12:05 p.m., look into having Fahrenheit 9/11 sealed as a classified presidential document. 1:30 p.m., start reading Clinton's book. 1:33 p.m., have staffer finish Clinton's book. 4 p.m., make bold stance against beheading. Reassure the South that hanging is still okay. 5 p.m., initiate Operation Distract Voters with the Olympics. 6 p.m., devise bold visionary plan for universal health care. 6:15 p.m., get distracted by yummy pudding. Abandon bold visionary plan for universal health care. 9 p.m., lights out. Wow, Clinton got to sleep on the couch. Cool. You can get to sleep on the couch too, GW.
You know, I heard that and I couldn't figure out why there weren't any more bedrooms. Do they only have two bedrooms, one for the presidential couple and one for the daughter, and then you have to go on the couch? I didn't understand that.
Maybe that was part of the punishment. Like, he went down the hall of the bedroom. She went, no.
Nope. You're not coming in here.
Yeah, we have to pretend we're living in a two-bedroom suburban home.
It's the punishment.
Exactly.
There's nothing worse than the couch.
You're right.
That's a long night when you're, like, got to sleep on the couch. I was never good at it. See, when I fight with my wife, or even when she was my girlfriend, With me, there's no, you know, you don't do that. You resolve
it. No, you leave town.
No, but don't you pretend you're reading? You just stay up and say, I'm reading, and you stay in the living room. You don't say, I'm sleeping on the couch. You just say, I can't sleep. I need to read.
No, I don't. If we fight, we really fight. I mean, it's like, you know, blast. It's like screaming and yelling, you know, and, you know, because I'm a fighting kind of person. And it just gets ugly.
No kidding. But then no one sleeps, or you do sleep in the end?
Well, I'm a kind of guy that, you know.
Who backs down? Anybody?
No, she starts crying, and then it's over. Game
yes!
over. It's just game over.
Okay.
Is that it?
Well, no,
you melt.
No, it's not a matter of melting, but then, like, if you had any real point, which
there isn't. No, it's just no fun anymore.
Here's what happens, is that usually when you're having a fight, it's not because you have something to fight about, or you have a point to make, or you're right or wrong. It's because you're 7 years old inside, and you just want to go, come on, cry. And then she, like, cries. And then, you know, usually, you know, if you're lucky, you know, some part of you, the grown-up inside you, would grab hold of the child and said, you know, shut up.
No!
You know, don't you realize she can just take her vagina and leave? You know, so what happens to me is that, you know, there has to be resolution. Because once she starts crying, then, like, there's no conversation anymore. I'm to blame no matter what. There's no reasoning. There's nothing. So I have to resolve things. There's no sweep on the couch. There's no leaving. There's no running away. It has to be resolved, or I go crazy.
I thought you could say you have to grab the child and then say sorry.
Huh?
I thought you...
That's of course. That's of course what it means. You grab the child and say, and then you just sort of, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's when no one leaves until I cry and apologize. She cries first, and then if it gets really bad, I'll pretend to cry, and then we resolve it.
Oh, I got a question.
I think my head's hurting.
You've never gone to step two, which is look. I don't care. Go ahead. Keep crying.
God, you're worse. You are bad.
Dude,
my wife, like Mishna, will just she gets so crazy when she gets upset. Like I really am. I get truly afraid. Not physically afraid, though. She is bigger than me, taller, and probably stronger. But there's that moment where you're like, you know, they can leave, and it freaks me out. Like maybe it's abandonment issues or what. So I've really learned my lesson. I don't fight anymore unless it's for real. You know, unless we really have something to talk about. I won't just do it because I'm an insecure idiot.
So you don't get into it over as long as you don't get into it over fidelity issues. Fidelity issues are a dangerous thing. In case you don't know.
You mean
that,
jealousy?
Right? No. I'm talking about fidelity issues.
I don't have that problem with this one.
If she thinks you're doing something that you're actually doing.
No, what's worse than that is if you're actually doing it, that's the problem.
Well, right, yeah.
Well, I got nothing to hide here with this wife, you know, and I've been in that place before. And I think that if you have a clear conscience with the person you love, that, you know, you're definitely on the same page. And I try not to get jealous because that goes nowhere. Because, like, I used to be a very jealous person, and I solved that with mathematics, actually. Did you know you can solve jealousy with mathematics?
No.
Because here's how.
They can teach us that in algebra.
It's a sign of maturity, I think. It's like what I started to realize, like, is like, you know, I've had, you know, we've been together for 5 years. We've had sex like hundreds of times.
Mm-hmm.
So if she goes out and sleeps with the guy once, mm-hmm. I'm still winning. You know, the numbers.
Unless she says it's better than all the hundreds of times she did it with you. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but then you have to really address another issue. It's not about better or worse. It's about whether emotions are invested.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe that if she were to do something like that, I'd like to think at this point in my life, because of what I've been through, I'd be able to have a conversation about it. That's what I like about Clinton, actually, is that they were able to, you know, transcend something like that. And a lot of relationships don't.
Why am I hearing the Jimi Hendrix version of Hey Joe, Where You Going With That Gun?
But I just think it's if she were to do something like that, you just have to, I mean, you'd have to say, you know, well, do you want to be with that person?
But you bring up an interesting point on that, because that's why I always felt that people gave Hillary Clinton a really hard time. Women especially gave Hillary Clinton a really hard time, and conservative women, for, you know, bad-mouthing her, and doesn't she look like a fool, and why is she sticking around? And, well, because, you know what, stuff happens in a long-term marriage, especially with personalities as complicated and attention-seeking as Bill Clinton's, and you deal with it, and you move on, and there's some stuff that you just decide that you are going to you know, handle, cope with, discuss. I mean, Clinton's talked a lot about having therapy, family counseling, counseling with Hillary. Yeah, frankly, I'm a bit tired of hearing all the therapy stuff. But the, you know, the point about
you're very anti-therapy. You're like
no,
sort
I'm
of
not.
Like you
no,
know,
no, no,
stiff
no,
upper
no.
Lip.
You know, I'm not,
therapy
I
for weaklings and girls.
No. I am absolutely pro therapy. I am just not pro hearing everybody talk about having their therapy. That's all.
Yeah.
I mean, I love your dream diary, but I don't want to hear Clinton going on and on about, you know, having therapy, because at some point I sort of find it kind of a bit insincere, as if what think it's just, his book promotion is sort of one big long kind
well,
of
Oprah-fied
publicity tour.
Is the regaining, if that happens, if there is a transgression that is about fidelity, you know, what you have to deal with is, can you get trust back?
Right.
And also, what did it mean? You know, I think a lot of dudes just do it because they can. Like he said, they do it, doesn't mean nothing really. They just want to get the rocks off and forget about it. You know, but the truth of the matter is that that's not a good enough reason. You can't tell a woman that, like, you know, I just did it because I had nothing to do. I was bored, and, you know, she called.
That's why I was a, you know, defender yeah. of Hillary. And I remember, you know, at the time, you know, being on kind of TV shows where people want you as a pundit to kind of, you know, talk about, you know, oh, how ridiculous, you know, Hillary's a fool, and, you know, she's just a doormat. And I think that, the right wing of America wanted to make Hillary look like a fool, and it was part of this whole kind of family values thing, and, you know, fidelity is you know, paramount, and that how could you handle that? And I think that within I think Hillary has dealt with a lot of stuff in her marriage that many other people deal with, and it's foolish and kind of naive and disingenuous to think that she is not a fairly common example of a modern marriage, stretched
well, look, you
over
know,
decades.
There were a lot of Hillary's biggest critics later were found out to have fathered kids out of wedlock. You remember Henry Hyde, and there was one other guy in Congress.
Well, that's the thing about all those women, too, is like their biggest fear is that, you know, their husband will have to, you know, that will actually tell them the truth. I mean, I found that, like, you know, women who are the most, like, freaked out, you know, they're completely paralyzed with fear that their husband's doing the same
right.
thing, and they'll
was,
never
it,
address it.
It was exactly, it was the women's criticism of Hillary that I found particularly galling, because I know that many of those women, they know that stuff is going on in their marriages, and they know even if stuff is not going on with their husband, there are things in their marriages that make them unhappy, that are imperfect, and they don't want to acknowledge it to themselves, and they don't even want to acknowledge it to anybody else.
I am so glad I have a perfect marriage now.
Yeah, me too. And before we go to our plea for world peace, let me say that I have never cheated on my wife.
We got that on record.
Straight ahead, Robert.
I've never cheated on this wife either.
Robert Reich on Bill Clinton's book.
I've never cheated on any wife.
There you go. Recovery
Ooh.
Corner. The liberal agenda. And remember, our blog is at airamericaradio.com. This is Air America Radio.
How are you? It's 8:30. No, it's not. It's 33 after.
And let me say, there's nothing scarier than the Mark Riley headbanging with his headset on.
Riley was giving
That's
me
right.
the heads up with the headbanging. Mark Riley, Sue Elcott's here. I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition. We have a blog now, morningsedition.com.
Yeah, I messed that up before. I said it was airamerica.com. It's not. It's morningsedition.com. .com.
And we mentioned that great logo that somebody sent in.
It's not up yet, so let's wait.
Oh,
let's
okay.
wait on
All
it.
Right.
And then we'll figure it out
Take
how we
back.
Want to give him credit. But, James, look, I'm just going to say this. We talked a little bit about fueling cars with French fry fat, and I was encouraging people yeah. to keep eating, and now the fat people are mad. I'm not picking on fat people. Okay. Number one. And here's another one. Hey, Mark, why don't you let the fat folks run in cages like hamsters, spin the wheel, collect the electricity, and use electricity for the cars? They can lose some weight and lower health costs. I'm going to talk to Robert Reich about that momentarily.
Do you know?
He would probably like that idea. And I always wonder when I go to the gym, it's like, we are wasting so much.
In Wales last year, there was a run on plastic bottles of cooking oil because people were buying them up and converting their cars
into
to
the
run
fuel.
Them on them. And the supermarkets just ran out. You
yep.
couldn't get oil to fry your food.
Right now, we have on the phone former Clinton Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He's the author of the book Reason, Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America, which I just finished reading and I loved, and we're going to talk to him about it, but we're also going to talk to him about Bill Clinton. Robert Reich, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mark, and good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Sue.
Hello.
Robert, I loved your book. I want to talk to you about it, but I want to ask you a couple questions about Clinton first.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to his little performance last night?
Well, I thought he did pretty well. You know, the book is going to be great beach reading.
Yes.
I mean, the problem is going to be getting it to the beach and back from the beach. You're going to need a wheelbarrow.
Yeah, or affording to go to the beach after you've kicked in almost 40 bucks.
But it's a good read, I think.
1,000 pages, man. That'll take you all summer to do it.
It's going
to
take several summers.
Do you think that... Do you think... Why do they keep focusing on all the... How fair is it that so much of the attention is focused on the Lewinsky thing?
Well, I think people still remember... They're going to remember two things about the Clinton administration. One, the good economy, and secondly, Monica Lewinsky. And that's what people... You know, it became the kind of saga of the administration, the perils of Pauline, and certainly the second half of the Clinton administration, you know, between 1996 and 2000, that's just about all anybody heard.
And Robert, let me ask you, I mean, how much, what he said about the right-wing conspiracy, that was a moment that I, when I see him get angry, I find him very engaging and very intense. And he's got a big chip on his shoulder about these people trying to run him out of office and really coming up with nothing.
Well, they did try to run him out of office.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, let's face it, he was there. They did everything they possibly could to run him out of office. These are the same people, by the way, who basically took the election away from Al Gore when Al Gore won the popular vote.
And they'll do it. They're devious, and they were
devious relentless. Is an understatement.
Okay, well, use it in a better word. Give me a better word.
They are. Well, I won't say they are. I would say that they will stop at absolutely nothing.
So they're shameless, devious, and evil.
That's pretty good.
How about demonic? Demonic out of you?
How about relentless?
Relentless, shameless, devious, and evil just about summarizes it.
So Clinton said his biggest achievement was the economy. How do you feel about that?
I think the biggest achievement was the economy. Now, granted, you know, by the late 1990s, most people in this country were much better off than they are today. If John Kerry asks people, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago, most people are going to say no.
Right. So you want him to ask people.
And I think that the good thing about the book is that it reminds people that the economy 4 years ago was good, and the economy right now is lousy, and foreign policy right now is completely bogged down in Iraq, and that has almost nothing to do with fighting terrorism, if anything to do with fighting terrorism. I think that a reminder of how good the years were under Bill Clinton is probably a good thing.
Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary, you just said that, you know, most people, if asked this year, you know, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago, they would say no. Don't you think that the kind of, for the very richest people in America, they would say yes, and that's the problem. Most people would say no, and lower income people would say absolutely no.
Yes, well, that's exactly right, but there are only 25 very extraordinarily rich people in America, and their votes don't count all that much, although they do make big campaign contributions.
But I mean, people who qualify to be the millionaires and over, people who are more likely to vote for Bush. I mean, how many of them are feeling poorer now?
Well, they're not feeling poorer, and the widening gap between rich and poor in this country is a scandal. But median income, that is the income of the average person smack in the middle of the income ladder, has gone almost nowhere. And in fact, if you look at compensation, total compensation, including health benefits, those people are much worse off than they were in the year 2000. And they are the ones who do vote. I mean, we have a big problem in this country, obviously. Half of Americans don't even bother voting, and many of those who don't bother voting are poor and or they are young.
Okay, can I ask you one thing about, because we're getting into the area of your book now, and it's something that I read your book. I thought it was great. It was very informative, and it's sort of a primer on how to be a liberal in the modern world here.
How to survive as a liberal,
empower yourself.
But liberals will win the battle.
Well, what you were saying before, talk to me a little bit about the myth of moving towards the center.
Well, there's no center in America. I mean, basically, over the last 20 years, Republicans have stood fast with their principles, and they haven't budged. And Democrats, every time they compromise with the Republicans, the Democrats shift the middle to the right.
Right. Stay with us, because I think we should get more into this, because there's some other questions, too, I wanted to ask you about outsourcing, about the new jobs in the country. I think a lot of people of our listeners want to hear it. So you stay with us?
I'll be right here.
Thanks, Robert. Fantastic. We'll be right back with Robert Reich and more information. We want to take some calls? Yeah, why not? 866-303-2270. Maybe he'll answer some of your questions. 866-303-2270. Come back to Air America. 42 past the hour. Mark Riley is here. Sue Ellicott is here. This is Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. We got Robert Reich on the phone. I am Mark, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Mark.
And in Recovery Corner, I reach out to fellow 12-steppers who are struggling to stay clean and sober. Today, as always, I'm offering counsel to my temporary sponsee, George W. Buddy, I know you give, I give you a hard time, but down deep, I know you're just a hapless stooge. A little man way over his head. An empty suit who just wants to clock 8 hours at the job and then go home and play video golf. I know, I get it. Hell, half of America is willing to reelect you for those reasons. Dick Cheney, totally different story, my friend. You may think Cheney, you may think of him as a big brother. If your big brother, you can think of him as a big brother if your big brother's an abusive monster composed of borrowed robot parts. All right, look, on 9/11, there he was, down in the bunker, ordering the military to shoot down planes that had already crashed. And you came out and said, sure, that's exactly what the vice president should be doing. Why do you keep enabling this man? You are a codependent as well as an alcoholic. You are what we call a double winner, George W. Your addiction to drugs and alcohol is sad, but we can work with that. But Cheney's addicted to the scariest drug known to men. That's power, my friend. And he'll never stop until we're all living in bunkers, shooting missiles at other bunkers. Do not help this man. Detach with love, my friend. You got to go to the other kind of meeting now, too, double winner friend. Do not let robots run the world. Remember, denial is not a river in Egypt. Sobriety is a journey, not a destination. Humility is our acceptance of ourselves. Okay. One day at a time.
I like to keep the plug in the jug
because yeah. Who likes
Mark,
it?
I like that one.
Yes.
This is Bob Reich again. I think you're way too nice to Dick Cheney.
Dude, I think
right, toughen up, pal.
I think one day we're going to see. I keep saying, I think one day he's going to be talking in public and a lizard is going to crawl out of his nose, across his face, into his ear, and Tom DeLay will be standing there going, oh no, it's happening in public.
Okay, well, if you're being too nice, it has to be a nostril for each lizard.
I mean, these guys are really dangerous.
I know.
Bill Clinton, say what you want about Bill Clinton, you know, and the new book. But he was not dangerous. I mean, he may have been, a little bit, with Monica Lewinsky, it may have been indiscreet.
Yeah, but not
lying about sex in the White House is not anywhere near what these guys are lying about.
I'm afraid for myself. I mean, that may be partially my own paranoia, but I mean, I don't feel safe. You know, just being an American, opposing these people's views in this country, given the climate right now.
Well, I mean, what your email is being read, and your library cards are being looked at, and you're being. I mean, I even get copies of your email, Mark.
Oh my God! You're not seeing the websites I'm going to, are you?
Yeah.
So, Robert, like what we were talking about before is your book, and I want to stress this because, like, you know, I don't read everything I'm supposed to read, but I found your book very engaging, and it really educated me to a lot of ideas that that helped me. Now we have a caller right here that I'm not taking the call, but he's saying that Bill Clinton was a centrist, as many Clinton Republicans as Reagan Democrats. What is this idea of centrism that it just doesn't exist? You have to stand up for something, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can't lead people if you're a centrist, because by definition, people are already there. You can't lead people by following the polls, because the polls tell you where they are already, and you can't lead them to where they are already, because they're already there.
All right, let's take a quick call here, because Tad seems to have something to say that you might get you going. Tad, New York, how are you? What's on your mind? What do you got? A question for Robert?
Yeah, right before the break, Sue said the rich have done better under Bush than under Clinton, or she suggested it because of the tax cuts.
Right.
But I want to put it to the secretary. I think that's a fallacy. I think the rich do well when the markets are robust and the economy is terrific and job growth is strong. And so I think Clinton was great for the rich.
Okay, thanks, Tad. Robert, what do you say?
Well, I think that Clinton was great for the rich. He was also great for the poor. The poor made more progress under the Clinton years than they've made in the last 20 years. The gap between rich and poor did widen. The caller is exactly right, but it didn't widen nearly as wide it has widened under the Bush administration. I mean, you see, let's take chief executive officers, for example. In 1990, before the Clinton administration, the average chief executive officer of a big company
yeah.
was earning about 90 times what his employees were earning. By the year 2000, he was earning, it's usually a he, was earning 500 times what the average employee was earning.
Whoa.
Now, when we went into recession by 2001, with all the stock options declining, that CEO was earning only about 300 times what the average earner was earning, and now that CEO is back to Fat City. But with the tax breaks and the tax cuts that George W. Bush has given to those CEOs are now earning far, far more after taxes. mm-hmm. after taxes.
Robert Reich, should the Democrats, I really believe the Democrats ought to be happy to see Bill Clinton reemerge, come out with this book, travel the country. Yet we keep hearing that there are some people, some folks even connected to the Kerry campaign, that act like John Kerry will be seriously hurt by this reemergence. Where do you
No,
stand
I don't on? Think Kerry will be hurt. I mean, look, at Bill Clinton is enormously popular, particularly in the so-called blue states that went for Al Gore. You know, on the coastal areas, Bill Clinton is enormously popular, and those people are going to vote for John Kerry, but having Bill Clinton around may make them even more ardent about their votes because they will remember how good the Clinton years were. In the heartland, particularly the red states that voted against Al Gore, those people are probably not going to vote for John Kerry anyway. The people who are waffling or in the middle or independents or who are undecided, I think that actually the Bill Clinton book over the next couple of weeks, over the next couple of, maybe it's more than a couple of weeks, are going to remind them of how good the economy was. I think that's perfectly fine. It's going to help. It's going to help John Kerry.
All right, last question, Robert Reich. You talk about in your book about sort of the Democrats needing to really come together, get passionate, get focused, get mobilized, as a group. How's Kerry doing with that?
I think Kerry is doing just fine. He's holding, he is keeping his powder dry on Iraq a little bit because he wants the critics inside the administration to be able to have their day and the focus to be on what they say instead of politicizing everything. I think he's absolutely right about that. He just came out for a major increase in the minimum wage. He said roll back the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts, on people earning over $200,000 and put it into health care for people who don't have it right now, health insurance. Mm-hmm. You know, these are major important issues on domestic policy, and I think Kerry, as we get closer to the election, people are going to hear what Kerry is saying. Right now, they're focused on other things.
Right. He's not as in the main stage as he will be in upcoming months.
Oh, yeah. After August, everybody's going to focus on the election. Right now, most voters are saying, do I really want this incompetent named George W. Bush to run the country? And look at what's happening in Iraq. And look what's happening to the economy.
Right.
And look at what's happening to civil liberties. And look what's happening to the environment. No, I don't want this incompetent there.
And we're going to try and move that along. Thank you, Robert Reich, as always,
thank you.
For being
Mark,
here.
Thank you.
Take care, Mark, Sue.
Thank you.
Have a good
the
day.
The book is Reason, Why the Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. And it is, I really would say that it's required reading if you are certainly as uneducated as I am in some areas of liberalism and what you can and can't do and what it means to be a liberal in the contemporary political climate. Come back. We've got the liberal agenda coming up, and we're going to talk more about sex. Maybe not. Air America Radio. Is that the Rockford Files?
Yeah.
Wow. Hey,
even
you guys,
I watched that.
You guys,
that's how bad and cheesy and exportable it was.
Hey. You talk about you said you had never seen Hogan's Heroes.
I haven't.
But it went to England. We had an email or say
well,
that Hogan's
parents,
Heroes was on in England.
My parents were very restrictive of what TV we watched. It was Star Trek, Alias, Smith and Jones, what's it called?
That cable?
That cowboy one. The Virginian.
Oh, the Virginian.
Oh, the Virginian.
Hey, you guys broke the blog already.
Thanks loads.
No. Apparently the blog went down because it just got overwhelmed with all the attention. The blog took on the personality of me, and everybody was coming at me, and it just crumbled. I don't do that. What am I talking about? Did I promise to talk about sex again? By the way, I'm Mark Maron. This is Mark Riley and Sue Ellicott here.
Hi.
Nice to meet you. Welcome to Morning Sedition. If you've
nice
never been
you
here
too.
Before, it's nice to have you. As I said, the blog is Morning Sedition. .com, but it seems to be freaking out. So I don't know why I said I was going to talk about sex, but I did.
I'm not allowed. My daughter listens to this.
It was a Freudian slip.
No. I think it's important to talk.
Your wife's not up yet, is she?
Oh, she's not up yet.
Uh-oh.
She's not.
But okay, go ahead. Say whatever you want.
I just want to say that I am excited and thrilled to be with somebody for as long as I've been with her for 5 years and still be completely compelled and excited by every bit of her being.
Really?
Sexually and otherwise.
I saw that you all had your arms around each other the other night.
Yeah, we do that.
At,
she was frisking
Friday
him.
Yeah, yeah. It's all very.
And she wasn't reaching for your wallet. I mean, that was the good.
not that particular moment. But no, she's not like that. You know,
but you're very publicly affectionate, and that's a nice thing.
I'm finding that one of the great things for a marriage is to be separated for 3 weeks at a time. You know, every other week. here we are newlyweds.
Oh, here we go.
We're newlyweds. You know, basically, it's 2 months, and now I don't see her for three weeks.
That's
why, it's like, oh my God, come here, let me have some now.
It's the electricity of repossession.
I love her smell, man. I love everything about this woman. It's nuts. And like, it's like, no matter how crazy she gets, and no matter how ridiculous things get, I just sit there and go, oh, I get to have that. I'm amazed sometimes when I wake up and she's sleeping in my bed. I'm like, how is it possible that I have that woman in my bed? How is that even possible? And believe me, everybody who sees us together, they ask the same thing. How could that guy? The way people look at my wife is insane. But after a while, it's kind of exciting. You're sort of like, yeah, you like that? Well, it's mine. How are you? Nice to see you.
Wait a minute, you're not saying she's a trophy wife, are you?
No, but she's hot.
She's his trophy. That's all she
is. Hot. So do you want to talk about something important?
No.
What is more important than that?
There is nothing more important.
Absolutely.
That's absolutely correct.
Do you find that the distance helps your relationship, Sue?
I wouldn't say with kids especially, no. It's a very different thing.
It's different.
When you're being an absent mother, it's incredibly tough on everybody. Oh. Most especially, I think, the mother. Because the kids get on with their lives and their school and granny and grandpa and daddy. And I'm the one who feels like I've had a couple of limbs amputated.
And they're like, mommy who?
No, they're not. They're not actually. They really adapt. They just, you know, they see me most weekends.
Oh, it'll come back at you.
They'll be there. Yeah.
You wait. They're in therapy.
My mom left me when I was a little child.
I'm saving for the therapist. No, you're kidding. I had a friend whose mother went away from Chicago, from Midwest of Chicago, to work, and she still is disgruntled. She's in her mid-40s.
Wow. There's the agenda from the Streisand compound. Get your pencils, your notebooks out. Here's the liberal agenda for today, June 21st. One stage dramatic reading of Clinton's book with Native American drummers, mimes, and graffiti artists. Two, urge local theaters to provide anger counseling after showings of Fahrenheit 9/11. Three, celebrate summer solstice. Replace winter hemp parka with summer hemp sarong. Four, buy tickets for Madonna's summer tour, but only because of her shrewd political insights. She changed her name to Esther to honor her Kabbalah teacher. I can't say that word anymore. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Wouldn't it be nice if we all had fins? Yay! I can't say that word because I chose not to use the word retarded in the wrong way.
Oh, now see, there you go again.
Only when someone's late. The official version. We're behind schedule. We are retarded.
Oh, that's the right. That's not using it.
Exactly.
Yeah, the person.
Or in sheet music, I think you can use it.
Yeah, that's how I used to use it.
Or in the break.
Coming up on tomorrow's morning's edition, the author of Generation Kill takes us inside the U.S. mission in Iraq. Plus, comedian Jim Gaffigan joins us to talk about the Kerry fundraiser he's doing with, guess who? Mark Maron. That's tomorrow's morning's edition here on Air America Radio.